Yes, yes. Well, okay, but
you see, like, exacerbated.
Therefore, yes. Well, therefore, the general principle of sannyasa should be taken only after the children have grown up. Not only because grown-up children can take care of the wife, but they can take care of themselves. As long as they're dependent, they shouldn't be the father should not leave the mother alone. You know, abandon the mother with dependent children. Sannyasa should be taken after the children are grown. If you don't want to wait that long, don't have children. Yes. Yeah. Shouldn't be imitated. We should understand what's different about this. He didn't just, you know, here's a special arrangement made. The child is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Kardama is not only arranging economically the economic security of Devahuti, but she's going to be given the divine instructions of Kapila Deva's, you know, teachings and get liberated. She's competent. She's competent to get
the. Yes,
because Vishnu told him that. He said, "I'm going to take birth as your son." He knows it.
And does he grow up full grown legally, or does he have to?
No, I don't think he has popped out fully grown. But that part isn't described. You know, in chapter 24, we don't hear about him as an infant and a child. It's left out, but we can assume that, you know, he grew up normally. And it is mentioned once that he traveled all over the world. So it's not just it was not his only pastime that he taught his mother. He also went around the world and preached. And we hear in the ninth canto how he was meditating at Ungasagara. So the whole life of Kapila Deva is not told in the third canto. Yeah, not to be imitated at all. It's not Kardama's dealings with Manu, that's exemplary. That we should follow in the footsteps of. But not how Kardama took sannyas. That's exceptional. Not normal. Not the standard procedure to immediately leave home after the children are born. The worst thing to do. And it happens, you know, too often, you know, dump a wife with a 2-year-old child. If you're frustrated, what is she supposed to do? What's the child supposed to do? It's a crime. If we had extended families, it wouldn't be so much a crime. But especially when nobody takes care. You know, it's nuclear family, and the only person that's going to take care is the immediate family. Okay. Anything else on this? Before we move on. Yes. Yes. And there's a limit. Yes. But in traditional society, there were other family. Go back to the parents. There are other people. Brothers live together. So there's more flexibility. What if a man dies? A woman's left a widow. But if we have extended families, we have villages in which families take care of one another, then there's more security. But we're so addicted to sinful activities, we have to have our own apartment so we can indulge in everything and nobody sees what we're doing. Now, so your parents don't see the nonsense you're doing, you want to have your own apartment. Therefore you don't live with your parents. That's modern love. You're doing, you know, the children are doing things that the parents would never condone, But if we live according to traditional standards, then we can live with our parents, and they can tolerate us. And that's required. The grandmother should be there, you know, to take care of a young girl who's barely grown up herself, to have a newborn baby, have to take care of the baby. She doesn't know what to do. But when the grandmother is there, then the grandmother can take a lot of the burden of raising the child and teach the young girl how to be a mother. So, you know, the parents not only should be respected, but they have an important role. The old people teach us how to live our lives if we have them around and don't kick them out. Okay, so move on to verse 20.
Yato bhavat vishvamidam vichitram samstasyate yatra javavatishtate prajapatinam patiresha mahyam parampramarnam bhagavan anantaha.
The highest authority for me is the unlimited supreme personality of Godhead, from whom this wonderful creation emanates and in whom its sustenance and dissolution rest. He is the origin of all Prajapatis, the personalities meant to produce living entities in this world. So if you want to take the risk of getting married, of a material entanglement, first have this kind of consciousness. Now get trained up in Krishna consciousness, and then you may encounter some difficulties, but you won't fall down. You won't give up your Krishna consciousness. And you'll be able to come out the end as a survivor. And the important, very important point brought up here. Here's the voice of the Brahmins. The king is the authority for the less intelligent citizens, the weak members of society. He protects them, and they can't lead themselves. He leads them. The authority for the Brahmins is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We have some statements from the Vedas. In the Vajrasayana Samhita of the White Yajurveda, there, the Yajurveda describes, you know, the Yajurveda priests chant the magical incantations that actually create the sacrifice. So a lot of the rituals of the sacrifice are described in the Yajurveda. Yajur means sacrifice. So the sacrificial incantations are the contents of the Yajurveda. So here, in the 10th chapter of the White Yajurveda, the rituals for installing a king. We actually were reading some of the commentary on this section when we were reading from chapter 6 of the Shatapatha Brahmana, which is the commentary on the White Yajurveda. Here's the original mantras of the White Yajurveda. In the section that describes how to install this, how to perform the sacrifice for doing the Raja Abhishek, installing a new king. So there's one mantra, the priest announces to the people,
Visha Eshavo Miraja Somo Smakam Brahmana Nam Raja.
This is the king of you, the citizens, but Somaraj is the king of us Brahmins. So, there's no mention here of Krishna, but why Soma? In the Soma sacrifice, when you bring this, you have sticks of the Soma plant that have to be prepared to make the Soma juice, which is the main offering in the sacrifice. if you have an 11-day sacrifice, on the fifth day, I think, you offer an animal sacrifice. But that's just preliminary. You know, offering the horse or whatever, that's not the main offering. The main offering is the soma juice. Only the 10 principal demigods are allowed to drink the soma juice. Only, I think, 6 of the 16 priests are allowed to also take some soma prasad. And the yajaman, the sponsor of the sacrifice. Nobody else can have soma. Aspama soma mamrita abuma. We have drunk the soma juice and become immortals. You become a demigod. You get entrance into heaven by drinking the soma juice. The asuras, they took all that trouble of helping churn the milk ocean because they wanted to get some of that amrita, which is soma. So, in the soma sacrifice, you have to purchase in the part of the ritual. Brahman sells the soma and you purchase it. And so you have these sticks of the plant. They have to be brought to the sacrifice, and then over, I think, the course of 2 days, they have to be prepared. You have to ferment the soma plant, and then you pound it, and chant the Pavamana prayers, and then a beverage is made from them. So when the soma is first brought, the soma that's been purchased, it's placed on a royal chariot, a special little ratha cart built to bring Soma Raj, the king. King Soma, he's the king of the Brahmins. Because that's Chandradev, is the presiding deity of Soma. So he's the king of the Brahmins. Just like, you know, sometimes Nanda Maharaj is not a king, he's not a kshatriya, but he's king of the cowherds in Vraja. There is no kshatriya in Vraja. Maybe if there was, the place wouldn't be so unruly. But it's ruled by cowherds. Nanda's the king of the cowherds. Or Vyasadeva married Satyavati, or Parashara had a relationship with her first. Vyasadeva's mother, I'm sorry, Parashara married Satyavati. Her father was the king of the fishermen. He was a fisherman, he wasn't a kshatriya. So every class, if they don't have a kshatriya ruling them, each separate class community has their own king then. So Soma is the king of the Brahmins. Brahmins aren't ruled by kshatriyas. Kshatriyas are under the Brahmins. They rule everybody else except for the kshatriyas. Except for the Brahmins. So that's explicitly stated in the Dharma Shastras. Gautama Rishi in his Gautama Smriti says, Raja Sarvas Yeshte Brahmana Varjam. The king is worshipable by everyone except for the Brahmin. Now, question arises. Does that mean the king can't punish a Brahmin ever? Can a Brahmin get away with murder? Or anything he wants to do? Okay. Let's argue it first, but I have a statement from somebody's commentary on the Gautama Smriti. But we can give our own opinions first. So they called him Brahmabandhu. But he couldn't, you know, even the Brahmabandhu shouldn't be killed physically. There's a condition there. You don't kill him, but you can punish him if he does some real nonsense. Okay, any other comments on that? Okay, so this is confirmed by the prominent commentary called Mitakshara. I forgot who wrote that. And the Yajnavalkya Smriti is a different smriti by Yajnavalkya Muni. But Yajnavalkya, while commenting on Yajnavalkya's Dharma Shastra, this Mitakshara commentary refers to the Gautama Smriti. So It says, Nataraja, in the commentary, Nataraja sarvashyeshte brahmana varjam, that's the quote we just read. Iti Gautama vachanat na brahmano danya iti mantavya tasya prashams artatvat. It is not that when Gautama says the king is worshipable by everyone except the Brahman, it's not that we should conclude that a Brahman is never punishable. Gautama's statement was just meant for praising the Brahmins. Now, a Brahman is basically better than a Kshatriya in most respects, in most circumstances. He should not be disrespected by the Kshatriya. But the Kshatriya still has to maintain the principles of Dharma. He's the administrator. He has to supervise and see that everybody is doing their duty. And so he also supervises the Brahmins. At least, you know, if they transgress seriously, he has to take care of that also. He may be committing some aparad by doing that, but he has to take the risk. He has to risk his own security or his own spiritual security for the welfare of the state. Even if he has to commit aparad against the Brahmins, he has to protect the country. Okay, so that's all that part of it I have to say at this point. Yes. Yes. And he did what? It's rare though. It's rare. In the Bhagavatam mostly Krishna, just like in the case of Nriga, the story of Nriga, when he was cursed by a greedy Brahmin, you know, wouldn't agree to just trade one cow for 100,000. Still, Krishna defended the Brahmins. He says, you should always be careful to respect the Brahmins and don't ever touch their property. He's telling his Krishna to hold his own sons. So that the bias of the Bhagavatam and of Krishna himself is to give the Brahmins the benefit of the doubt. Yes. Oh. No. No, you want to? No? No? Yes. 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 Case of Bali Maharaj rejecting the instructions of his guru. Okay. So, having said that, I'll just read the English here. Shri Maitreya said, O great warrior Vidura, the sage Kaurava said this much only and then became silent. Thinking of his worshipable Lord Vishnu, who has a lotus in his navel. As he silently smiled, his face captured the mind of Devahuti, who began to meditate on the great sage. And then the rest of this passage describes how the marriage was arranged. So the sage accepted. He said, I accept. Then Kartava, the last thing he had to do was make sure that his wife and his daughter actually agreed. So he got their consent. That's described in verse 22. And then, since this is Brahma Vivaha, it's expected that the girl is being offered as charity. There should be a proper dowry along given to the girl. The dowry belongs to the girl, not to the husband's family. Nowadays, it's just a bribe. You know, you have to come up with a big dowry to get rid of your daughter. And the family of the groom, they want to, you know, get enough of a dowry. If they don't, then there are cases of, you know, accidents in the kitchen where the girl's burned to death just because the dowry wasn't big enough. But no, Shatrarupa arranged very carefully that many valuable presents were offered as a proper, suitable dowry. Ornaments, clothes, and various practical items for household use. Because it doesn't mean toasters and, you know, radios and televisions. No, it means gold, you know, plates, gold, jewelry, practical things. Not only can you eat off the gold plates, but if there's bad times, famine, or some economic disaster, you've got gold and jewels that you can sell readily on the market and survive. Okay, let's read verse 24.
Pratam duritaram samrat sadrikshaya gatavyataha upagushya cha bahubhyam alkantyon matitashayaha.
Thus relieved of his responsibility by handing over his daughter to a suitable man, Swayambhuva Manu, his mind agitated by feelings of separation, embraced his affectionate daughter with both his arms. So it's a great burden to have a daughter and have to get her, find a suitable husband for her, you know, raise her up to, you know, to a young grown-up girl, and then find a proper husband. This is difficult. Provide a proper dowry. This is all great burden. But there's an end to it. Once you've got her married, your responsibility is over. So, in a sane social system, everybody's responsibilities are clearly defined. Now, life is difficult and confusing, but at least if your role and your responsibilities are specified, you know what you have to do, then everything is, you know, more or less under control. Your anxieties are limited. You know, once I fulfill this responsibility, then my anxieties are finished.
Now,
Manu, Kardama already is predicting, you know, I'll, you know, accept all this material entanglement, we'll have the children, then I'm going. I'm taking sannyas. So he's defined the limits of his life of anxiety. Manu also, his... the scope of his material entanglement is here being limited, the limits of it are being defined. Gets his daughter married, then he has to go back and continue ruling the kingdom to the end of the Manvantara, rule the earth rather. But it's described in this chapter how Manu, it's in the eighth canto, chapter 1. It will be described how Manu ultimately, at the end of the Manvantara, attains perfect Krishna consciousness. Manu and Kardama, apart from their differences, they achieve the same perfection of Krishna consciousness in this lifetime, at the end of this lifetime. It's not the Varnashram system. It's not a principle of our Varnashram system that you have to take your next birth, the next step up the ladder, and take several births. You can become fully Krishna conscious in one lifetime, no matter what your position is. The opportunity is always there. It's not that being a Shudra means that you've got several lifetimes to go. No, you can, a Shudra can become perfect. Yepishu papayonayaha striyo vaishastata shudras tepi yanti paramgatim. That can be accomplished. That paramgatim can be achieved very quickly in a matter of even years or even months if someone is very serious, takes complete enthusiasm to devotional service. So Manu is relieved. Still, he's a human being. It's described that his mind is agitated by feelings of separation. Oh, my daughter is now going to leave home. We won't see her again. Natural emotions. He embraces his daughter. The next verse describes how tears flow from his eyes. And he's crying out, oh, my Amba, calls his daughter mother. And then he leaves the girl in the care of her groom and returns to Brahmashmati, his capital. Any comments or questions here? If they're not living with brothers, if there's not any other extended family, then the girl would go back to her father, a widow.
Why is she meant to give up her mother?
Yes?
Why is she meant to give up her mother?
That's never mandatory. This is sati, or the woman jumping into the funeral pyre of her husband. That's only for exceptional women who cannot tolerate the separation of their husband. It's never obligatory. Okay. And Prabhupada and even Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they had no argument with the British law that it's illegal, sati, 1829 or whatever. The British East India Company passed a law. Under the Hindu, they had separate laws for the Hindus and Muslims, but under Hindu law, they made it illegal to perform sati. And our acharyas don't argue against that. In the modern age, it's not appropriate, even voluntarily, for women to jump into the funeral pyre. Yeah, there should be. No. That's Brahma Vivaha should be solemnized properly. The marriage ceremony is not being mentioned here. It must have happened. It's just there it must be skipping over that detail in the description. Yes, that minimum. The girl. The principle, basic essence of it is that the girl is being given as a gift to a person who is suitable to receive such charity. But then it should be solemnized by a Vedic sacrifice. This is not ordinary human culture. This is culture of the sages, the Japanese. They're living in a world above our heads. This is Satyuga. People, just like nowadays, everyone wants to, when they finish their necessary business, they want to sit down in front of the television. So back then, when they did what they had to do, like get married or this or that, they sat down and went back to their meditation. That's what people did for enjoyment. So that Kardama wants to get back to his meditation. He's not blamed for that. In that Prajapati culture. And also, Devahuti herself is a great yogi. So she can understand. She also would rather get rid of this household business and go back to her meditation. Well, Prabhupada discusses that. Manu's coming from Brahmashmati, his capital. But he says that some places just say that Brahmashmati is on the earth, others say that it's up in the heavenly planets. And he says both are true. The same places very often are reflected both on the earth, exist on the heavenly planets and have their replicas on the earth also. So his conclusion in the purport can be either or both, on the earth or up in some Maharloka or someplace. But Manu is the forefather of the human race. So he may have his capital up on Maharloka, but he's the first king of the human beings. Well, he's a son of Brahma, but again, Bindus, he's practicing his meditation at Bindu Sarovara, which is an identifiable place on the earth. So it looks like this is happening on the earth. Now what brings us all down to earth is that previously Brahma was populating the universe all by himself, just out of his mind. And Manu and Shatarupa are the first couple that propagated by sex, and the Prajapatis are following in their line, but it's a new thing. Sex is like a new thing in the universe. And there are many girls and boys to match up available. So, it's happening on the earth maybe, but it's not there. Perfection is described later on in chapter 24, the last chapter before Kapiladeva sits down with his mother and begins giving his instructions. Chapter 24 describes how Kardama, after he had his nine daughters beside Kapiladeva, so he got his nine daughters married. Kardama got his daughters married to the various sages. Brahma and other sages left headed by Maruchi, they came to congratulate Kardama on making the proper arrangements. But Brahma and those others who were celibate, they didn't stay for the marriage. Only the householder sages, Prajapatis, actually attended the marriage. After the marriage was complete, then Kardama's responsibilities were done. So he first approached his son Kapiladeva, who he recognized as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and offered prayers to him, took his permission, circumambulated him, and went off to the forest. And then it's simply described in about 3-4 verses how he perfected his meditation, his pure devotion, and very explicitly it states that he went back to Godhead. But that's it. He goes off to the forest, meditates, perfects his devotional service, and he's gone. That's why the Bhagavatam mostly describes the exploits of kings. The Brahmins don't do much interesting to describe. They simply meditate, do their devotional service, and they're gone. Doesn't make an interesting narration. Yeah, sat around for a long time, and died. Yeah. To attract the attention of the public, more attention is given, more description is given of what the kings did. So here is a description of what Manu did. He attained the same perfection as Kardama, but Kardama's perfection was described in 3 verses. Here there's some 15 verses or so describing 12 verses describing how Manu attained his ultimate perfection. Let's see, verse 29. Well, even though he was living as a big king, because he was a Krishna conscious king, his kingdom was very auspicious. It was a place for dharma was maintained, practiced very nicely. Actually, the name, we'll read the verse, it explains why the capital is called Bhavishmati. Bhavishmati nama puri sarva sampat. This is verse, 29 and 30. Bhavishmati nama puri sarva sampat samanvita
Nyapatanyatra Romani Yagyas Yangam Vidunvataha Kushak Kashasta Evasan Shashvad Dharita Varchasaha Vishayo Yai Parabhavya Yagya Gyan Yagyam Ijire.
The city of Bahishmati, rich in all kinds of wealth, was so called because Lord Vishnu's hair dropped there from his body when he manifested himself as Lord Bhur. As he shook his body, his very hair fell and turned into blades of evergreen, kusha grass, and kasha, another kind of grass used for mats, by means of which the sages worshipped Lord Vishnu after defeating the demons who had interfered with the performance of their sacrifices. So, you can't perform any Vedic sacrifice, even a simple one, without kusha grass and other necessary paraphernalia. Kusha grass doesn't grow outside of India, I think. Maybe it doesn't. You know, it's not on the market in America. So you can't perform a proper sacrifice without it. It's required for purifying the ground you're going to sit on. Bahishmati was such an auspicious place. All facilities for performing sacrifice were available. The kusha grass, kasha grass were growing all over the place. And that's, Barhis means kusha grass. So the city full of kusha grass, that's called Bahishmati. Okay? So, the advantage of this, yes. In this case, I don't know if that means that all the kusha grass should be considered Lord Varaha's hair, but in this case, when Lord Varaha's hair fell out, it turned into kusha grass. Yes. That's confirmed by the Dharma Shastra, the sannyasi is natural guru of society.
So in ISKCON, the one thing that has not been established that the system will have to be established is, what is the quota or the privileges of sannyasi who will know a little bit about it? We have some experience about work. But how the Brahmins, since they will have to, now within our society today, most of them can say, well, at this point, now we introduce Shetri's Vaishnavism to this one, the Parnashram established. But what would be the proper behavior of a Brahmin in relation to the other Brahmins in a social context? And this would not mention people who surrender to them as a disciple, but they have a natural position as Brahmins. As we see in the original Vedic culture of Vedas, the Brahmins are the street of school religions. And how the Brahmins and the sannyasis act in the social context.
Well, I think he's, you know, he's considered a guru, especially in his role as patana, teaching. You know, Brahman should be considered guru because he's shiksha guru, he's instructor. If he doesn't, a Brahman who doesn't give any valuable instruction shouldn't, you know, doesn't deserve the same respect. Just because he can do some puja for you. You know. know, or you can feed him. Well, you should do some service to preserve the respect. So the service that the Brahmin performs, the one that he earns his reputation as a guru by his teaching. So just like even today in India, boys and girls call their teacher guru. It's a kind of guru. It's understood it's not the same as someone who gives you Vaishnava mantra, but anybody who gives you valuable instruction should be respected as a kind of guru. So every Brahmin who has something valuable to say should be respected as a vidya guru, a guru who gives useful knowledge, even material knowledge. That should be the natural principle. Even in the corrupt Hindu culture, they understand that there's no difficulty in every natural for children to respect their parents, respect their teachers. But we come from the convoluted Western culture where we turn everything upside down, and it's a crime to respect anybody. It's considered you've given up your freedom, you've sold yourself to the devil because you have any respect for anybody. So I don't think it's a problem of discovering what's the norm. It's just that we're so abnormal that we can't begin to perceive it. It's right there. It's just natural life. It's the most natural thing for children to respect their parents and their teachers. But we've been so twisted around that we can't even recognize that. I think also what the social convention is based on is that natural relationship. The natural relationship with the Brahmins or the teachers. That's why they're respected. Because they give us our knowledge. Just like, you're supposed to worship the rishis and the demigods every day, but there's reasons why. We worship the demigods, you have to do Pancha Maha Yagyas. But, we're provided reasons why. Not just, because if we don't, they'll hit us with a thunderbolt. But we should be grateful to the demigods because they provide the necessities of life, the rain and everything else. We should be grateful to the rishis because they give us the Vedic knowledge. That's why we do daily sacrifice. The householders do daily sacrifice to the rishis. So similarly, the Brahmins should be respected for a reason, because they teach us. Okay, please. Yes, explain it then. Okay, I'm sorry. Are you satisfied with that? Okay, I guess it has to be figured out for this one. No, I guess it's... Well, you know, Brahman has to maintain the principles of Dharma. So if a serious crime is committed, theft is a serious crime. In the Vedic system, you get your hands cut off. So technically he should turn the servant over to the government, and if the government judges it, then the servant's hands would be cut off. Not that he does it, but he turns his own servant over to the king. Correct? But that... Yeah. But no, but it is. It's natural for Shudras to be dishonest and selfish. It's just that they have to be kept under control. Don't let them get their hands on things they can misuse. Don't give them money. You know, and keep the money locked up. If you leave your money unlocked and your servant steals it, it's your fault. Why didn't you lock it up? So they shouldn't be trusted. Yeah, Indians know that too. Yeah, when the cleaners come in, you don't leave the room. Yeah. So you don't condemn a Shudra for just being a Shudra. That's his nature. By his faithfully serving, he can be gradually rectified. Well, in the West, we're smart mleches, so we know it's good business, to be honest. You know, Indians haven't recognized that. So it's just good business to be straightforward in your dealings. But that doesn't make us any even proper Shudras. It just means we're clever. Yeah. Polished animals. You can't expect too much from Shudras. No. Their virtue is if they're faithful servants, if they have loyalty to their employers. That's their virtue. Can't expect much more. Can't even expect them to be very hardworking. They'll work if you're standing over them, they'll work. But the minute you turn your back, they'll stop. Obedience, yeah. And they may have their technical skills for which they can be honored. But don't expect high civilized virtues. And, we're fooled by Maya. In Europe, especially more in Europe than America, we have a veneer of culture. It's a very thin veneer. Yeah. We're actually barbarians who know how to pretend to be civilized. Polished animals. Real culture is not just putting on a show. Okay, Larry, quickly, we only have a few minutes because Janasmi Prabhu asked me to spend the last 12 minutes handing out this evaluation survey that he requested. Everybody sit down right now, fill it out. Don't give it to me, but leave it on this table before you leave. Okay, so I have to give time for that. I'll have to stop a little early. So let me just quickly run down what happens to Manu. Manu, he worshipped Vishnu, performed sacrifices. He lived in his palace happily, enjoying the company of his wife and his citizens. He didn't have any opponents, undisturbed by any enemies in his kingdom. The celestial musicians and their wives, the Gandharvas and the Apsaras, sang about his pure fame. And most significantly, the key to his success is that every morning he listened to Hari Katha with a loving heart. Busy man, but he had a solid morning program. He practiced sadhana bhakti. And just by that daily dose of Hari Katha, he went back to Godhead. So Swayambhuva Manu was a saint. I'm reading up to verse 34 if you want to follow it. He was a saintly king. He was absorbed in material pleasures, but these sense gratifications, this bhoga, was not capable of degrading him. He didn't become corrupted, even though he was indulging in material pleasures. Because he was Bhagavat Para, he was seriously dedicated. His life was dedicated to the service of the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada says in the purport that he, Manu, always enjoyed his material happiness in a Krishna conscious atmosphere. So Manu lived for the duration of the whole Manvantara, 71 Divya Yugas, 71 times 331 third of a billion years. A long time. And eventually his life came to an end, but he didn't waste his life. All that 330 million years wasn't wasted. Because he always listened to, contemplated, wrote about, and spoke about the topics of Lord Vishnu. Always, for the whole 71 Divya Yugas of his life, he was always thinking about Lord Vasudev and acting for his service. Thus, he transcended the three destinations of people in the three modes. The destinations of attaining higher planets, of living on the earth, or the lower destination of becoming, going to hell or becoming an animal. He transcended all three kinds of destinations. There's no possibility that Manu could have been disturbed by the obstacles caused by the body, caused by the mind, caused by other human beings, and caused by the forces of nature. He was able to withstand all these obstacles. And Manu is very famous that for the benefit of all creatures, when the sages inquired from him, he taught the diverse sacred duties of men in general, and specifically of the different varnas and ashrams. In other words, he spoke the Manu Samhita, which we have today. It's available. There are many useful commentaries on it. It's been translated into English. The Manu Samhita that we have was originally spoken by Manu, but the version we have is not Manu's own words. They're the rendition given by Bhrigu. Bhrigu heard from Manu and then Bhrigu wrote it down. So we have the Bhrigu recension of the Manu Samhita. It's actually narrated by Bhrigu Muni, who heard it, who learned it from Manu. And so there are many verses where it says, so says Manu. Manu wouldn't quote himself. It's Bhrigu quoting Manu in various verses. Okay. That's all that's said in this chapter. There, if we look at the first chapter of the eighth canto, there's a short description of how Manu finally went back to Godhead. He wasn't in the eighth chapter of the first chapter of the eighth canto. It's described that Manu remained free from attachment to sense gratification. He finally gave up his kingdom toward the end of his life. And he went to the forest to practice austerities along with his wife. He stood on one leg for 100 years on the banks of the Sunanda River, and he offered prayers to Lord Vishnu. And then some rakshasas and asuras who saw him doing these prayers, they wanted to eat him. And Lord Yajna, the incarnation, Lord Yajna was described as the Yugavatar for Satya Yuga sometimes, the personification of sacrifice. He appeared with the demigods called the Yamas, and he killed all those demons. And so, and that Yajna, Lord Yajna, he became the next Indra, and Manu was able to continue his meditation and attain ultimate perfection and go back to Godhead. So, anyway, both the Brahmin and the Kshatriya, in the end, because they took advantage of their adherence to the Vedic culture as a facility to support their practice of Krishna consciousness, they were able to successfully prosecute Krishna consciousness and perfect their lives. Both of them attained ultimately the same goal. Okay, so I'd like to thank everyone for your patience. This was an experimental class for me. I'm not that learned on this topic, but I just see the necessity. These things have to be discussed. And I think the most valuable source of knowledge for this and all topics is Srimad Bhagavatam. That's why I chose to base the class on the actual narration of the Bhagavatam. Yes, please. Of the Manusam? No. No, but I've looked at the available English translation. It's old, but I think it's accurate enough. You know, I didn't see anything objectionable with the translation that's published by Motilal Bharanasi does. Motilal Bharanasi does? Anyway, I think it's the only English translation available. If you read Hindi, there's various Hindi translations. No, almost nothing. There's some description of the creation of the universe from Lord Vishnu, but the service, devotional service of Lord Vishnu, is not. There's maybe a few places where he recommends it, but it's really not part of the narration. It's all about material topics, duties of the varnas and the ashrams. It's how to live your material life. If you want to know how to live a spiritual life, that's available in other books. Yes, I mean, yeah, but that's... Vedas are not... What's described in the Vedas is not all directly Krishna conscious either. Okay, now we have to do this. Pass around these. And you're requested to... I don't even know what's here, but fill out... And before you leave the room, fill it out and then leave it here. Anyway, thank you again, everybody, for your participating and giving good ideas. And I guess you don't need me for this, I'll take my leave.
I like the singing of the Sanskrit word. No, actually, no, the sarva should be echoed like that only when you get halfway through the verse or the end of the verse. Right. And the second or fourth line, whatever you agree, other places it shouldn't be echoed. It should be echoed. You just pronounce it very weakly. And you know, H, you know how like voice consonants are voiced? H, regular H sound, ha, is voiced. This is an unvoiced. When it's not echoed, it's unvoiced. Somewhere like the German ich, but weak, very weak. This is kama. In fact, they don't hear it. Kama. Yeah, you just don't emphasize the words. Kama. It's very, it's, you know, it's a trace of it, kama. Okay.
And
Like I read some verses from the Vedas which do have intonation.
Ah, oh, the Samaveda.
Like here, no, the Yajurveda,
the Samaveda.
But the Yajurveda, these are the low tone, high tone, and the other ones that are not marked in middle tone.
Ah, that high tone.
Yes. So those, the actual words have fixed intonation.
Isha, Isha, Ishogo. Viraja soho svakam ramananam, no, ramananam raja.